Какие молодые люди?
Вежливые молодые люди.
Зеленые человечки, имеется в виду.
Были эти известные зеленые человечки, которые...
Конечно, встали наши военнослужащие. Они действовали...
Они там уже и так находились. Извините меня, по-другому мы просто поступить не могли.
An invasion that's not quite an invasion. Operatives who aren't quite troops. Aggression, no doubt, albeit aggression with plausible deniability. We've been in this place before, although it didn't always make international headlines. We're here in the conflicts in Georgia's breakaway regions of Abkhazia and South Ossetia in the early 1990s. We were here in the conflict in Moldova's separatist Transnistria province. We were here dramatically in the run-up to Russia's August 2008 war with Georgia. And here we are again today in Ukraine. It's been called hybrid warfare, asymmetrical warfare, and ambiguous warfare. But warfare it is, and Russia appears to have perfected using it to achieve its geopolitical aims. The little green men are probably here to stay. Is there any way to counter them? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me in the studio is Mirhat Sharapjan, a senior correspondent and analyst with RFERL's Central Newsroom. Welcome, Mirhat.
Hi, thank you for having me here.
And joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hey there, guys.
So the script's been the same over the past decade, as has been the result. Exploiting a local ethnic conflict, Moscow uses local proxies and then some stealthy special forces to seize de facto control of a breakaway region in a former Soviet state. The paramilitary effort is mirrored by an information campaign that creates a reality we all know is a fiction, but that we need to react to nonetheless. In a blog post back in April, Mark, you wrote the following, quote, "The soldiers of this war are spies and criminals, cynical lobbyists and gullible commentators, businesses desperate to make a profit from Russia, and populations eager not to see themselves engaged in any civilizational struggle." This pretty much sums it up as well as anybody has. How new are these tactics? And what, if anything, can the West do to counter them, in your opinion?
Wow, two big questions. Let's start with the first one, how new? In essence, there is nothing new about any of this. For heaven's sake, one can go back to the time of the Roman Empire, busy trying to sort of set different barbarian tribes against one another to see the truth. The point is the context is so dramatically new. First of all, that with modern communications, modern democratic structures and so forth, on the one level, we might think that it allows governance to be that much more efficient than ever before, but it also allows the willful spread of misgovernance to be vastly more efficient. Second key thing is that we are in a post-ideological age. Or rather, there are many, many ideologies, but the world is not shaped by ideological divides. And therefore, a player such as Russia can mix and match freely. And we've talked about in previous podcasts about sort of Putin's attempt to position himself as a sort of conservative, social conservative icon and such like. So basically, there's a whole variety of different ideological sort of groups to which the Russians can appeal. And I think the third thing that has changed is actually the potential speed of warfare. When it does come to military action, there is the capacity to move dramatically quickly, as we saw in Crimea. It's been a classic Russian approach that Putin has refined, which is that you move fast to shape the ground truth, and then you more or less turn to the international community and say, well, you know, what are you going to do about it now? In a way that if you're having to move troops on foot or by steamship, it's a lot harder. Mm-hmm. So time-honored tactics, but really brought to, I think, a very dramatically elevated form by the modern context.
Yeah. No, in terms of how new this is, a NATO official told me earlier this week that anybody that thinks this is new should go back and read their Clausewitz. Because it's certainly not new, but you're right that the context is new. Now, one of the things I spent the earlier part of this week at NATO headquarters in Brussels, and I know one of the things the alliance is dealing with is trying to come up with a way to handle this in the future, because it could pop up in new places. If you were advising Western governments about what to do to counter this, what would you tell them?
Well, I would say, first of all, that on the whole, this is not actually NATO's job. NATO is the fire brigade. NATO is who you call when actually the conflagration has burst out, and that's when they come in and they deal with it. So yes, one can talk about ways in which they can sort of sharpen some of their capacities, you know, making sure that they have the kind of sort of special forces that particularly who can operate in mixed civil unrest come proper, you know, kinetic warfare sort of context, that kind of thing. Because it's always otherwise a problem. You know, as the British found in Northern Ireland, that often the kind of forces whom you train for real warfare, like the paratroopers, actually are singularly poorly suited for dealing with mobs of rioters because they have a certain sort of set of instincts sort of drilled into them. So fine, there are things that NATO can do, but actually far, far more effective is deterring and, as far as you can, proofing your system against these tactics. And those are essentially ones that are actually about the systems of governance and the attitudes within countries themselves, which is not NATO's job. I mean, broadly speaking, you've got to be able to combat the disinformation with effective and plausible truth, which is what, after all, you know, everyone tries to do anyway. But nonetheless, you know, you need to have mechanisms, which means things like, you know, good journalistic structures. Secondly, you know, you need to have a high level of transparency within your political and your economic structures so that, for example, it is clear that if there's a lobbyist or a politician or a business magnate who's giving a particular line, that you have a good sense of, well, okay, but how far, you know, are you owned ultimately by a Russian company or paid by a Russian company, that kind of thing. You need to have probability. I mean, one of the problems, and this is what we've seen with the sanctions, is that actually there is a considerable body of evidence to suggest that even already you have people within Western financial systems who are looking to how, in the name of business, they can conspire with Russians to get round the sanctions.
There was a letter from U.S. executives from the U.S. American Chamber of Commerce in major U.S. newspapers saying that let's not do tougher sanctions just this past
week. And the final point I throw in is inclusion. Yes, the Russians are happy to work through Russian-speaking minorities when they are available and convenient, but that's by no means the only potential agents that they will turn to. They will look for any weak point. So whenever you have communities or groups or regions or even just political fractions which feel disenfranchised, which feel dispossessed, which feel unhappy with the status quo, the Russians will often seek to play on that. So again, I mean, actually what you need is to ensure that as far as possible that these people are content, are willing to accept the status quo. These are all big systemic challenges, but they are political challenges and economic challenges. They're not the sort of things that NATO is for.
Right. And again, and that's something NATO is very aware of. And one of the other things, one of my other takeaways in Brussels was that NATO realizes that it has to, that they're just part of this and that they have to work in partnership to counter this with other with others. The European Union came up again and again and again, of course. But what you just spelled out, Mark, is basically civil society building. It seems that simple. It's civil society building. That's the best inoculation against these kinds of tactics. I don't see the Russians trying these tactics in Brighton Beach, for example, where there's plenty of ethnic Russians, right? Mm. Now, an interesting thing also this past week, I was speaking to some Estonian journalists. And Estonia is a country that, on paper, at first glance, one would think is very vulnerable to this kind of thing. Large ethnic Russian minority concentrated in the eastern part of the country. But supposedly, according to the Estonian journalists I spoke to, Moscow had sent a fact-finding mission to Narva and to eastern Estonia to see if the conditions were ripe yet for something like this in Estonia. I don't know if this is true. This is something I got entirely from Estonian journalists. Certainly plausible, though, right?
Absolutely.
The conclusion of this Russian fact-finding mission was that the conditions are not ripe for anything like this right now or in the near future, for that matter. And, God, I could have told you that from what my own Moscow correspondent told me after going to the region and reporting a story out there about the conditions among the ethnic Russians in eastern Estonia. So we're talking about building civil society. Is that the only thing that's a big job in and of itself. But other than that, what is there? because
there's, I mean, again, there's the nuts and bolts of things like having, you know, I mean, one of the things that has become clear are the weaknesses of Western intelligence in picking up the signs of Russian movement and being able to identify Russian plans in advance. So yeah, absolutely, I mean, one can have these kind of forces and these kind of capacities. But if we flip it around and look at Ukraine, and there's always a danger here. It's a little bit like sort of blaming the mugger for not knowing karate. So the mugger's victim for not knowing karate. But nonetheless, I mean, one of the reasons why Crimea was just so easy for the Russians to take is because Crimea had been so badly managed by Kiev for so long that you had a criminalized local elite in place, that you had a population who felt precisely that they'd been abandoned and therefore were perfectly willing to give Moscow a try on the principle, not unreasonable, that Moscow couldn't be any worse than Kiev. And you had security forces who, you know, even before questions about loyalty because of the fall of the Yanukovych regime arose, were so thoroughly penetrated by corruption and inefficiency that when it came down to it, they were scarcely in a usable state. So, I mean, I think one has to accept that actually where the Russians have tackled enemies, you know, without, they do so really when they feel that those countries are there for the taking. Mm-hmm. Rather than being hard targets. I mean, absolutely, civil society, intelligence structures, and military structures all need to be addressed in the name of basically target hardening.
Mm-hmm. Once the conflict starts, and I want to get to Marcotte in a second, but I wanted to throw. I mean, once suppose you do all that and it happens anyway, you get the situation on the ground, or you don't do it. How do you fight this once it's underway? How do you fight this once it's underway?
Obviously you need to have high levels of precision and speed to be able to actually sort of move. And this is one of the problems. I mean, although we are seeing a fight back by the forces of Kiev, on the whole, they're having to do so with the National Guard and similar elements that aren't highly mobile, that aren't highly professional, and therefore they're something of a blunt instrument, which raises the danger that they will end up doing something counterproductive. Because I think the key thing is, and you mentioned Clausewitz, I mean, is actually recognizing that even when the shooting has started, this is still primarily a political activity. Mm-hmm. That yes, of course, you need to be able to foil, you know, whether it's hitting ammunition convoys or strange and mysterious tanks coming across the border, if that's what's happening. You know, you need to have the precision and the responsiveness to be able to do that. But the main thing is you are trying to ensure that you win a political victory. And in this respect, I mean, I think it's worth noting that, again, it's something that the Russians have been aware of in a much more purposeful way than we have. I mean, your colleague Rob Coulston, you know, recently raised and sort of translated this fascinating article from 2013 by the Russian chief of the general staff, General Gerasimov. And let me just quote one quick sentence from Rob's translation. The role of non-military means of achieving political and strategic goals has grown, and in many cases, they have exceeded the power of force of weapons in their effectiveness. Mm. Now, he was looking at the Arab Spring when he was writing that. But the whole point is exactly that the aim is a political one. In this conflict, often non-military means are going to be decisive. So actually, it might well be that the capacity to, for example, very quickly move forces to key locations may well even preclude the need for them to shoot. Mm. I mean, this is something that we saw in Ukraine, is actually that the Russians moved at first a little bit more hesitantly in the east. And then when it became clear that Kiev was unable really to do anything about it, then they became far, far more bullish. You know, the Russians are aggressive, but also, ironically enough, a little timid with it.
Mm,
so, I mean, I think that's the key thing. I think it's actually is to try and preclude the need for major displays of force by ensuring you have the right people in the right place quickly.
Mm. America, we were talking in the newsroom the other day, and you were saying that it's very obvious that this thing had been planned way in advance.
Yes, everything is clear that the whole thing is a very thoroughly worked out plan. If you look at the in April, for instance, there's just small facts. All of a sudden, the Federation of Migrants in Russia, led by a person from Bangladesh, Muhammad Amin Mujadir, they announced that they want to persuade State Duma and President Putin to allow migrants in Russia to serve in the Russian army and to protect, I'm quoting here, to protect Russian interests anywhere in the world. And, well, we know Russia, we know what the Soviet Union was, you know, even any society, even the society of the people who like to grow rabbits is always under control of state bodies. But this organization surely, directly or indirectly, is under FSB's control. And the fact that all the state-controlled media outlets started reporting about their statement and their open letter to State Duma and the appeal to Putin, well, makes me sure that this was organized. And then, of course, State Duma said, well, we accept that, but then we'll consider, but it's probably too early and stuff. For me, it looks like a signal. We just get recently some reports saying that there's some Uzbeks in the ranks of pro-Russian separatists who are most likely migrants from Uzbekistan, and a picture of one of them was shown on by Reuters recently. And our correspondent called several telephones, phone numbers, which were shown on the internet, advertising the companies which recruit people who want to fight in Luhansk for Luhansk People's Republic or for Donetsk People's Republic. And he said, well, me and my friend, we are from Uzbekistan. We want to fight there. They said, well, it's possible. We are ready to solve all problems we have with the papers in Russia. So we know that only from Tajikistan, there are more than 1.5 million people permanently living in Russia and working there as migrant workers. And the majority of them don't have proper documents. You know, they have to leave the country in 1 year, or sometimes they are not able to, or, you know, there are so many other issues. Well, what I'm saying here is, to me, that story about the address to the State Duma was kind of a signal to migrants who, if you want to get legalized in Russia, you can go there, and you know, and people like this, not
you can
only
be mercenaries, basically.
Yeah, not only. I'm just giving the example of one small group, not small, but one group. Which can be used by the system.
This gives Russia kind of a reservoir of potential recruits that they can have plausible deniability when they deploy them. Does it not, Mark? I mean, you send a bunch of Russian migrant workers who have been recruited to work to be mercenaries in wherever the next battlefield may be.
Why it's very well organized. Just look at the how they look like. In Crimea, we saw green men, they were in a brand new uniform, and it was clear, even though they didn't have any signs or insignia showing that they are military personnel from Russia, it was clear that they are from Russia, because you cannot get this latest brand new types of uniform. In the case of Luhansk and Donetsk, if you look at them, it looks like they intentionally, it's like a theater or something. All of them have all the very, old uniforms, military. Who keeps that kind of uniform at home? where they got it? You know, they and even there,
it's like they're trying to look like a ragtag band.
There's another impression. They're a completely different impression. It looks like they were given these uniforms, ramshackled, old, dilapidated uniforms from some place, which was distributing it for them. And one more thing.
The Kalashnikovs with the tape on it.
Kalashnikovs. Look at the Kalashnikovs. It looks like somebody specially beat them on the wall and put the tapes on the magazines and, you know, all the other stuff. I mean, this is, it's interesting. And again, today we heard that one of the representatives of Dmitry Borodai. Pay attention to the surname. It's not Russian. It's more Ukrainian or Belarusian. It's also intentional. Who is prime minister of Donetsk People's Republic.
Well, he's from Moscow.
Yeah. But why he has this surname? Yeah. I mean, this is also for, you know, consumers in Russia, in Ukraine. You know, and the name of his representative today, who spoke today, is Sergei Kaftaradze. You know, this is
Georgian
also
name,
it just reminds me Rustam Temirgaliev in Crimea. You know, all of a sudden, somebody who was born and grew up in Buryatia in Siberia, who is a Volga Tatar by origin, But, you know, who gives a damn? I mean, he sounds like a Crimean Tatar.
Right.
Or he probably, there are some Crimean...
But that failed. That effort
with
him
failed.
Yeah,
well, that failed. But what I'm saying is everything, even these details are worked
out. Right, they're worked out. They've worked out. They've Mark, anything to add to what...
I'm a little more skeptical about the idea that this is sort of this kind of carefully choreographed grand plan. I mean,
well, don't you think they had it?
The art of planning is to ensure that you can take advantage of opportunity. Yes, of course, they had contingency plans. That's what militaries do.
Yes,
they have all kinds of
exactly
contingency plans. But, I mean, I think, for example, you know, I mean, I think if we look at the question of migrants serving in the Russian military, I mean, that's been around for years. I mean, that's been periodically sort of raised and discussed.
But it suddenly got legs this year.
Absolutely, and no wonder. Though, I mean, given that, you know, one can look at the French Foreign Legion or the British Gurkhas, you know, it's not exactly unique. But, I mean, I think, for example, if one talks about, you know, the ragtag look of the fighters in Luhansk and so forth, I mean, I think it does seem clear that the overwhelming majority of the fighters actually are Ukrainians from Ukraine. Mm. They're clearly sort of leavened with all kinds of additions, ranging from sort of war tourists to actual Russian special forces and intelligence officers. You know, army surplus is all over the place. You know, I mean, in Moscow, you can buy it on so many different streets, and you just see ordinary workmen wearing old camouflage and such like. I mean, I think there's a danger in reading too much into it, because particularly if one does that, it misses for me one of the key things about this new style of warfare, which is not that it requires this long, careful, grand planning. It's that precisely it takes advantages of situations. It ensures, I mean, in a way, the Russians ensure that they have the political, the military assets in place and the intelligence assets in place. So that when the situation arises, you know, I mean, none of this would have been happening had not Yanukovych fell.
Right. Mm-hmm. But they were ready. But they were ready should he fall. I mean, our Russian service just recently did a report showing how a lot of the political groups in eastern Ukraine with pro-Moscow bent, their ties already to Moscow. They had this ready to launch. And that's, I guess I'm not thinking of it conspiratorially, but the contingency was on the table and they just needed to flip the switch. No,
But then, I mean, say again, flip switch again. That on the one hand, if you look at Crimea, for example, I think it is fairly clear that that was, you know, all carefully planned through and done. That's one thing where they actually had the full plan. I think the thing with eastern Ukraine is that the Russians have been improvising. They had a variety of assets. They have, I mean, because at the moment, I mean, they're not, I think it's fair to say, entirely in control of the situation on the ground. But likewise, the way the Russians operate is by building contingencies. They will, I think it's entirely sort of clear, also have very different, but nonetheless, you know, very real types of assets in place in Central Europe, in Nordic Europe, and probably also in Western Europe. Now, again, it's not because they're actually thinking, you know, and on next Thursday we'll do Estonia and Finland slated for September. It's that who knows what might happen. Maybe there will be some sort of massive economic downturn that leads to big popular protests in Narva, and suddenly Estonia comes onto the table.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe for whatever reason, you know, they suddenly feel, God, we need to do something about Finland because Finland's becoming problematic. I think this is the key thing. If we think of it as something that is very, very carefully planned, we miss the point of the essential opportunism and the extent to which actually Russia will take advantage of the opportunities it's given.
Mm-hmm.
It will then make the most of it. But actually, Russia is not, I would suggest, in most cases, I mean, there can, some countries are different, but in most cases, Russia is not strong enough to create the opportunities. Mm-hmm. Instead, it exploits them.
It's interesting that you mentioned Finland, because the current Finnish government is making noises about possibly joining NATO. I'm not sure if that's going to get any legs in that society, but it's interesting that it's actually the country that the word Finlandization came from is actually making noises about thinking about maybe joining NATO someday. Merkat, anything to add?
Well, I think still there are some, even I agree that there's some element of improvisation, but there's some calculations and preparations made before present here as well. You just look here in the Czech Republic, the 9th of May, I just happened to look to go across the Olshansky cemetery here. People in the same, it's not uniform, the same kind of costumes. I call them costumes because really it's a masquerade. with this Georgian bands and stuff, they're very determined. They don't talk to anyone. They look and they almost march. They go there. A huge number of Russian tourists who happen to be in Prague that day, they come to that cemetery, and then there were some people who appear from nowhere with some, you know, statements, slogans that we came here, we protected Eastern Europe, now fascists in Ukraine, and they are doing this in the European Union, and these tourists even don't remember that Ukrainians just wanted to join
to the European Union,
of which the Czech Republic is a member. But what I'm saying is, still, there are a lot of organizations, groups, which are, if not controlled, but supervised by FSB or similar organizations close to FSB in Russia, even in what we saw in Crimea, those Ryazhenny, those who were wearing the Russian Cossacks uniform and were there completely, probably have nothing to do with Cossacks at all. Always, there were some people, persons in their 50s next to them, if you just watched properly. They were kind of trying to say, to tell them what to do and what not to do. They're always there, and at least these people were instructed beforehand. And, I think this example with the migrants right after the annexation of Crimea, just a week after that, in April, this statement comes, and all state-run media in Russia covers it. So this is not by chance.
No. One thing I wanted to touch on, Mark, and you mentioned early on the notion that we're in this ideological age, or an age when it's not ideologies that kind of organize the world. It's almost this postmodern, post-ideological phase. But two of the – I listed in prepping for this this broadcast, I listed kind of five components of how this works from preparing the groundwork to the information component to the political component, demos, et cetera. But two things jump out at me as I'm looking at this right now. The information component, establishing alternative narratives, establishing a false narrative. That's one. And the other is the importance of the de facto over the de jure, right? Mm. And essentially what we're having here is this – it's like the territory of the fake – in the territory of the real, in a lot of ways, and that is what. And if you remember the slogans of God, of the Bolotna demonstrators, we want to live in real politics now and get out of this fake politics. Isn't that the thing? One of the things that's kind of dividing it. There's this part of the world where things are as they seem, and the narrative is kind of close to reality, and the de jure is in fact important. And another part of the Eurasian landmass where the creating facts on the ground is more important than the rules, and creating an alternative narrative that you can repeat enough times and therefore makes it true. That's what's most important. Is this the divide we're seeing now? This just popped into my head as I was looking at my notes here. But what do you think?
Let me kind of disaggregate two elements of that. I mean, first of all, the rules, and then secondly, the issue of the fake and the real. I mean, absolutely, if one has to think, well, what does Russia stand for in geopolitical terms, apart from just simply Russia's self-interest? It is a challenge to the existing world order and the whole set of rules and understandings that underpin it. Russia is an ardently revisionist power. And the point is that one of Russia's great strengths is that the other countries have to still continue to observe the rules. Not least because I mean, they're worried that if they also say, okay, fair enough, then the rules aren't working, all bets are off. What happens to then, you know, a country like China looking at its various territorial disputes with other countries if it suddenly thinks, okay, well, we're now in much more of an anarchic world in which might makes right? So, I mean, actually, you know, Putin has identified a real weak spot for the West in that, yes, we have to follow the rules to a far, far greater extent. But in terms of the issues of narratives and truths, I mean, in some ways, let's be honest, I think the West is a bit of a victim of its own evolution. I mean, the extent to which we now live in worlds mediated by spin and propaganda, you know, are extensive. I mean, whether it's listening to politicians repeating the same talking points rather than actually answering the damn question, whether it's all the kind of ridiculous sort of, shall we say, sort of distortions of the truth that we see in advertising for products, you name it. I think, you know, we have a Western population that is actually is accustomed to the notion that they're being lied to all the time by their own people. And therefore, they are, in some way, again, going back to your earlier image, they are not inoculated against the real lies of the tinfoil hat brigade who tell them on RT or whatever that 9/11 was a fake, and that, in fact, NATO started the Ukrainian conflict and whatever else. Again, I mean, I think what Putin has done...
identified another weak spot then?
Yeah, absolutely. You're spot on. This is how the Russians operate. We give them the opportunities. We give them the ammunition. I mean, just as France is selling the Mistral-class assault carrier to the Russians, the West as a whole, by virtue of the imperfections within our political system, gives the Russians the opportunities that they take full advantage of.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is something I want to follow up on in the second half when we broaden this out a little bit and look at this, if this conflict is indeed becoming what we think it is, how each side stacks up. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion of hybrid asymmetrical warfare and aggression with plausible deniability and ask, over the long haul, who's better poised to prevail in such an environment? I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me in the studio here in Prague is Mirka Sharipjan, a senior analyst and correspondent with RFERL's Central Newsroom. And joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Сегодня ночью в Южной Осетии грузинский
гранатомет «Град» был обстрелян
в центр. В данном случае применились модернизированные боевые вертолеты.
Это оружие, которое находится в руках у...
Mark, to get the ball rolling, I'd like to flatter you further by quoting from another piece you recently wrote. Well, you actually wrote it earlier in the Ukraine crisis back in April, when you argued that a better metaphor for where we may be headed is not the Cold War at all, but in fact, the Great Game. And let me quote from that piece, quote, "If anything, this is closer to the freewheeling days of the 19th century, and especially the great game of imperial rivalry in Central Asia. These conflicts will be won by whoever is able to force their enemies to play by their rules, and by whoever best understands that military force is often the least important kind of power. Like the great game, the struggles will be fought using deniable covert actions, political misdirection, economic leverage, propaganda, espionage, hackers, mercenary agents, and useful dupes." I would be willing to bet a lot of the money in my bank account that you are spot on with that. Now, in that same article, you said that Russia is not that well equipped to play this game. But on the other hand, they seem to be playing it well so far. So is this just a matter of the West finding its feet in this environment? How do you see this great game playing out over the long term?
Yeah, I think Russia is playing a weak hand brilliantly. Mm. In the long term, the West has, in my opinion, all the advantages. There are, of course, distinct challenges with democratic systems, and particularly alliances of multiple countries, in that, and again, in this I think speaks to the sort of the great game element, because no one regards Russia as an existential threat unless they happen to be immediately on Russia's borders. Mm-hmm. There is much less pressure for a unified front, and likewise, because this is, if we're going to call it a war, let's call it a conflict rather. It's a much more sort of episodic, local, and limited one. Countries are much less willing to pay the price of fighting. Everyone wants to, as it were, to teach Russia a lesson as long as it doesn't cost them anything. Mm. Which, of course, no conflict can be fought on the cheap. And finally, democracies inevitably have all kinds of weaknesses as war-fighting institutions. It's why most countries, even the most ardent democracy, frankly, becomes an authoritarian socialism when it's in a big war. But putting all that aside, I mean, one has to recognize that Russia militarily is pretty weak. I mean, this is one of the interesting things that we see in the context of the conflict with Ukraine, is that actually, and ultimately, could Russia beat Ukraine in a conventional war? Yes. But on the other hand, would it actually be a difficult, dragged-out fight that would cost Russia significant, not just in terms of lives, but in terms of material? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So Russia is militarily relatively weak. Russia is economically relatively weak. Yes, it has oil and gas, but it has to sell that oil and gas or it starves. That is an asset of only limited value. And in terms of its soft power, it's fascinating the way that Russia has become not the exemplar. No one is saying, gosh, I'd like to be like Russia. Though some people would like to think of Putin as an exemplar of certain values. But above all, it's the spoiler. It instead gets in and tries to undermine other people. So almost creating a situation in which, well, everyone is corrupt. Everyone is trying all kinds of sort of dubious things. This is an essentially sort of short-termist and negative way of thinking. Of fighting. And I think also it sort of relies on the West frankly being excessively scared of what Russia could do. Giving you one very specific example, I mean, it's clear that the British government is doing everything it can to ensure that sanctions do not reach the point where they begin to impact on the flow of Russian money, clean or dirty, into the City of London.
Don't touch the City of London, right?
Yeah, but on the other hand, I mean, Russia accounts for 1% of the City of London's financial services exports. 1%. Mm. Actually, that's pretty minimal. The City of London is phenomenally diversified. It could, of course, some individual institutions, which are particularly exposed, would notice if there was some major sort of clampdown or whatever. But in general terms, this is not something of which the UK ought to be worried about. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, it is allowing it to shape its policy. And this is, I bash the UK because I can. but generally speaking, this is something, every country is busy. The French are still selling military material and indeed training Russian sailors in how to go on the Mistral. Everyone is looking after their own interests.
And if Statoil stopped helping Gazprom with extract gas, Gazprom would be in deep trouble, if I'm not mistaken.
We need to mention also today the recent announcement of a BP deal as well. I mean, everyone wants to fight this war, this civilizational conflict, call it what you will, on the cheap and with no cost. Now, as long as they think that, then in a way they allow the much, much more focused agencies of Russia to have the advantage. But that's because Russia is able to focus all its forces while the Wests are all terribly diffuse.
Right, and I think you've pinpointed yet another weakness that Mr. Putin has located in the West, that we have no stomach for this, and they do. Right? Mm-hmm. But now, that said, now, how does this change over the long haul? How does the West begin to win this great game over the long haul?
Well, in part, precisely by seeing it as something for the long haul. I mean, it's fascinating that Russians who are connected with government structures or who just simply are kind of particular observers or whatever, no one seems to think that the sanctions regime will continue.
Yeah.
Everyone assumes, because that's how it's always been in the past, that there'll be some sound and fury and they've got to sort of survive 6, 8, 9 months, and then the West will come along and say, this isn't really working, let's, have a reset or whatever, and sort of it'll be back to square one. Actually holding on to the sanctions regime, even without extending it, in and of itself will begin to actually, as it were, re-educate Russians that actually now the West is different. So that's point number one. But secondly, I mean, it is addressing all these issues. It's addressing the fact that the West, particularly Europe, has become a courtesan state. That is happy to lift its metaphorical skirts anytime it gets a sort of hint of Russian money. Now, that's what we want to be, fine. But to be perfectly honest, that's not the one of West I'd like. I have no idea if that will make it to the
still getting
final
that
podcast.
Image. No, that I want. Oh, that will stay in the podcast. I'm just getting that image through my head, and while I catch my train of thought, Merkat, is there anything you'd like to add?
Well, I think Russia is unpredictable. There is a huge moments when there are moments when Putin. And in Russia in general, Russian leadership makes very unusual and unexpected moves, and especially in the very important international situations. And I think what West is supposed to know and to understand that with a game player like Russia with in the team, they have always to be ready for surprises. And how to deal with that, there are no common formula. There will always be different things to do with Russia. Everything depends on how much oil costs today, what's the price of this, what is the situation, you know, in the market, on how Russia's attitude to Ukraine and Moldova and Georgia after they signed the European Union agreements today. What's going to happen next? There will be some changes for sure.
So. Well, you touched on a lot has to do with the energy price, and I keep coming back to that. And at some point, we've got to do a whole podcast on energy. But I mean, if the West gets its energy act together in every way, I mean, and I don't mean just shale gas, and I don't mean just LNG, but I mean renewables as well. If Europe is not dependent upon Russian hydrocarbons, like you said, Mark, they got energy, but if they don't sell it, they starve. If Russia can't sell its energy at the levels it's selling it now and at the prices it's selling it now, there's no money for the little green men. There's no money for the asymmetrical information campaign with the alternative narratives and, you know, all these things they're doing, this sophisticated kind of new form of warfare that's not really new at all, but it's just being used in new conditions. They don't have the finances for that. Is energy the key, really? I know it's kind of stereotypical to say, but I just keep coming back to it.
Well, economics is the key, and yes, to a large extent, that means energy. Because everything that the Russians are doing is an economic drain. I mean, I think it's important to stress this, that yes, maybe in the long term there are hydrocarbons off Crimea or whatever, but actually everything at the moment costs. It's not being done to earn money. It is actually costing Russia money. And often in ludicrously disproportionate amounts. I mean, if we see that basically frozen pension money ended up subsidizing the Crimean reconstruction right. effort, to say nothing of the extent to which, you know, who knows what proportion of that is actually going to be skimmed off. And will instead be actually subsidizing Crimean gangsters and crooks and embezzlers of every kind. But generally, I mean, even on a micro scale, look, this morning I was walking past Novokuznetskaya metro station, and there was this sort of little tent kiosk of, you know, support, come here to provide support for the Donbass. A woman sitting there with a stack of leaflets, and so no doubt you could go there if you wanted to know which bank account to send money to, or maybe if you wanted to say, you know, give me a Kalashnikov and I'll happily wander down there now. Who knows? In thoroughly unscientific survey, I watched it for 5 minutes, no one paid it a blind bit of difference. But nonetheless, you know that whatever notional charitable organization set that up is in fact no doubt being used to funnel state funds in that direction. Mm-hmm. But so not only do they have to funnel state funds to support the Donbass through these various sort of deniable cutouts, but they also have to pay money in preserving the fiction that this is somehow a grassroots charitable thing. Mm-hmm. They have to employ someone. They have to have, you know, it was a very nice, clearly sort of, it was a professionally done little tent with its signs and so forth. You know, this cost money. So they're costing money to actually hide the fact that they're spending money right. on the Donbass. You know, all of this is expensive. The relatively efficient, polite men of the Crimea, the uninsignified special forces and naval infantry. I mean, the reason they were able to carry out the Crimean operation so successfully is precisely because they've sunk a vast amount of money into not just the military, but particularly the more operational maneuver forces like that. I mean, all of these things have cost a lot of money. And if you look at where they are trying to build even their soft power, whether it's through RT, whether it's through supporting extremist political movements in Europe or whatever. Again, what are they using? Is it force of example? No, it's money. Mm. Everything is fueled by money, and therefore it comes back to whether or not they've got the money. And yes, of course, they can get on to a certain length by simply diverting money from other uses. But how long can you actually drain pensions, hospital infrastructure, economic reconstruction, simply in order to fund empire without beginning to find some real political backlash?
And this is when they still have their energy market. This is when they still have the captive energy market. What happens when they don't have that captive energy market? I was on a program this morning with our Armenian service with a Russian colleague, and he said basically one of the reasons we're seeing kind of Putin back off right now, he's convinced that he's not appearing to back off, they actually are, is because this is costing too much money. There's just not enough money to continue this adventure, and that right now so much money has to be spent on the absorption of Crimea, which they absolutely must do that there really isn't enough for never mind any further adventures in northern Kazakhstan or the Baltic states or for even for eastern Ukraine right now. So their economic necessity is already having an effect. I don't know if I believe that. We'll see as this plays out over the next several weeks and months. Mark, I know this is an issue you've been writing a lot about. You care a lot about this whole issue of this asymmetrical warfare and this hybrid warfare. Any last words before we wrap it up?
I think it is just that sense that at the moment the West tends to rely on the instruments it's got, NATO foremost. And there is that old cliche about, you know, if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And I've heard one of the sort of the responses, well, what happens if you have little green men in Estonia or wherever? Well, you shoot the first one and then that dissuades the rest. But of course, the Russians are aware of that too. And the first little green man is probably going to be a 14-year-old local girl with a placard, whom you're not going to shoot. And then the second one might be a 16-year-old chap, but still a local whom you're not going to shoot. I think the key thing is it's essential to realize that this is a largely non-kinetic threat. This is not basically about tanks and missiles, the kinds of things that NATO can do. And the governments of Europe need to appreciate that they can't hide behind NATO. This is the European Union's challenge. And so far, it's a challenge that the European Union is manifestly failing to meet.
So, okay, well, let's, on that note, Mercat, last anything before we wrap it up? All right, well, on that note, we'll wrap it up for this week. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining me in the studio here in Prague has been Mirhat Sharipjan, a senior correspondent and analyst with RFERL's Central Newsroom. Thank you, gentlemen, for the informative and very fascinating discussion.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butodin, proprietor of the equally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper Noize MC.